suppose somebody told you a story like this with a straight face. This is a takeoff on an example of Bert and Russell. You have a cat. And you have a sofa. And often, the cat walks behind the sofa. So the cat goes in one side and comes out the other side. Now, suppose somebody tells you, I want you to know that when the cat goes behind the sofa, it disappears. The cat's not there anymore. Instead of the cat, there's a kind of blue-green foam oozing across. And when the blue-green foam gets to the other side, it starts to come out, and you're looking, it turns back into a cat. You say, you know, what have you been drinking? She says, look, I'll check. Your cat walks behind, and about half the time it takes, you run over, you look over the couch, and you see the cat. She says, there's no blue-green foam there. It's a cat. He says, no, that's because you looked. When you look, it's a cat. When you're not looking, it's blue-green foam. You know, anybody can make up stories like that. But let's suppose they gave you good, solid evidence to believe this. I'm not telling you what kind of evidence it could be, but imagine yourself in a situation where you believe that when you weren't looking, the cat turned into glowing foam, and when you looked at it again, it came back to being a cat. What would you think about the world? What kind of world am I living in? This is a world that cares whether or not I'm looking. Because when I'm not looking, it's blue-green foam, and when I'm looking, it becomes a cat. That's amazing. I always thought that the world goes on, ignorant of me, in bliss, not knowing that I exist. The cat and the sofa don't care whether I exist or not, they don't care whether I'm looking or not. And if I happen to look, then I'll gather some information about it. But it is what it is, and it just carries on by itself. Now I discover that I can make a difference just by looking. When I'm not looking, it's blue-green foam, and when I am looking, it's a cat. Wouldn't that be very strange? Wouldn't we have to sort of rethink what kind of world we're living in and how it's related to us and how we're related to it and the kind of effect we can have on it? Now, something resembling this is literally true. Not with cats, but with certain other things. And I've oversimplified it a little bit. I've taken off half the mathematics and half the tricky logic. But something like this is literally true. I want to show you where it comes from and give you the basic background. This is taken from a book named Quantum Mechanics and Experience by David Z. Albert. This book is published by Harvard University Press, so I guess it isn't just totally junk. He's a professor of philosophy at Columbia, so I guess he knows something that he's talking about. And the material that he's reporting in the first couple of chapters, which I'm giving to you, is non-controversial. Not his invention. Let's start with this. Maybe stand. You have particles. The real identities don't matter. Let's pretend they're electrons. They could be protons, they could be photons, they could be atoms of silver. Some particles, let's call them electrons. And they have two types of properties. We're not going to go into the fact that it's vertical spin or horizontal spin and what spin is and so on and so on. It gives them arbitrary names. These experiments have all been done. There's nothing mysterious here. He calls them color and hardness. Each electron has one of two colors, black and white. And each electron has one of two hardnesses, hard or soft. Now, there are machines that can test this. Take random electrons, push them through the machine, and they test. So on the lower left, you have the color tester. The electron comes in from the left. And then it either goes out horizontally, which is the white channel, or it goes out vertically, which is the black channel. So they're labeled W and V. This is a color tester. How do I know it works? How do I know it's really testing? How do I know it's not creating? How do I know what it's doing? Well, for one thing, if I push through electrons randomly, half come out white and half come out black.
It seems that electrons are sort of 50-50. But if I take an electron, push it through, and it comes out W, and I push it around again, it always comes out W. If I push an electron through and it comes out B, and I push it around again and go through again, it always comes out B. So this is my reason for saying that this box tests color. It doesn't paint them, because if it did, they'd all come out the same color, and they don't. On the other hand, it isn't just guessing. It isn't random, because if so, then when it came out W and I pushed it back through, half the time it would come out black. No, if it comes out white, go around again, it always comes out white. So this is a color tester. You could probably figure out how the one on the top right works. Same thing by analogy. It's a hardness tester. Goes out horizontal, it's soft. Comes out at the top, it's hard. It's 50-50. You put them through, and half come out hard and half come out soft. But you put one through and it comes out soft. To put it back through, it comes out soft every time. Put it through, it comes out hard. Put it back through, it comes out hard every time. So this is a tester of hardness. Okay, now, suppose we have a particular electron and we want to know both its color and its hardness. Can you guess what to do? Not too difficult, huh? Put it through the color tester. Let's say it comes out white. Then put it through the hardness tester, and it comes out soft. So now you know it's white and soft. Very simple, right? They did that. They did it. But you know, science is sometimes very careful. Very careful, very critical, very, very cautious. They want to test everything. So here's what they did. They put the electron through the color tester. Comes out white. They put it through the hardness tester. Came out soft. And then they put it back through the color tester, just to test again. And guess what? Now they come out 50-50. Half come out white, and half come out black. Why is that? Let's try this again. You put it through the color tester, it comes out white. If you recycle it, it always comes out white. Put it through the hardness tester, comes out soft. You recycle it, always comes out soft. Once you make a measurement, it stays stable. But if you do a double measurement, put it through the color, it comes out white. Then put it through hardness, comes out soft. And go back and test color. Somehow, you're back to 50-50.
The hardness won't paint it.
No, so you have to say something like, the hardness one interferes with the color. But doesn't just paint it, because it come out 50-50.
Paint it around.
Paint the rim. So it's got to have two paintbrushes, and they function randomly. Something like that, right? Okay. The trouble is that color and hardness are two properties that have nothing to do with one another. As far as we understand them, as far as we can measure them, as far as we can examine the devices, what happens in the hardness tester is just not related to what happens in the color tester. So it's very odd that the hardness tester should interfere with the color of the electron. Worse than that, they've tried to refine the hardness tester, make it simpler, have it interfere less with the electron, make it work on different principles. Now, not only does it, so to speak, stop interfering, but they all interfere to the exact same amount. Every time you push it through a hardness tester, no matter what kind of hardness tester, no matter what kind of design, more electricity, less electricity, more filters, less filters, mirrors with no mirrors, all the different kinds you can imagine, the color always returns to 50-50. No matter how you vary the hardness tester, the color always returns to 50-50. No one has a clue why the hardness tester interferes at all. No one has a clue how it is that you can have a dozen different hardness testers based on different principles, and they all interfere to exactly the same amount. Precisely the same amount. No one has a clue why this happens. That's not the problem. That's not the problem. That's just a question. It's something that's happening that we don't understand. The problem is much worse than that. Much, much worse than that. This is just an introduction to the testers. The problem, the unsolved problem of science. How come this interferes with that? That we haven't gotten to the problem yet. Yeah.
The point is, why are they doing the experiment? Because if color and hardness have to do with a combination of lots of electrons resonating relative to the nucleus.
It's one electron at a time. You get three electrons and you push them through one at a time. There's no atom and there are no other electrons, no other particles. Everything else is a vacuum. They go through one at a time.
Right. Right, so what about the Heisenberg and Zerny principle? We can't think of electrons as a particle. It's like...
We're trying to motivate that, right? This is the introduction to quantum mechanics. We're trying to motivate that. Okay? But these experiments are actually done. They're done with electrons.
But a color has to do with the... It's like electrons as a whole, like multiple electrons resonating.
We're talking about one electron at a time. There aren't any other electrons. We're doing one at a time. We're not talking about Bose-Einstein state. We're talking about one electron at a time.
So when it goes back into the harness, is that then random again, or I think you went when it goes another time?
You mean if it goes through the color again?
Yeah.
Yeah, then you go back to the hardness, it's 50% hard and 50% soft.
It doesn't have another effect on
it. It has both effects.
When you go through one, it changes the other to 50-50. Right. When you go through one, it changes the other to 50-50. Right. So each time you go through a different one, the original one goes back to 50-50.
This assumes that you can treat electrons as particles.
Well, the truth is that at a first approximation, you can, because every time you look, it's a little blip. It's like the cat. Every time you look, it's a little blip. Now, they're going to say, this is how I got into it with the cats, right? They're going to say that in between, it's not a little blip. But that's a big jump, because every time I look, it's a little blip. Every time I put something in between, it comes out a little dot on a screen. So why shouldn't I think it was a particle? What clue do I have that it's not a particle?
Yeah, and the bubble tread chambers with the trails.
That behaves like particles. Did you? Exactly. Every time I look, it's particle. Every time I look. But what we're going to see is that when you're not looking, it's murder. It's worse than blue-green foam. I haven't gotten to that yet. I'm just showing you how the things work and pointing out a little oddity that when you go through hardness, it somehow destroys the color. Go through color, it destroys the hardness. Okay, we don't know why that is. But, you know, this is the kind of thing which it's conceivable that future science is going to explain. You know, some tricky little thing about how the things are ionized or something, or the properties of space, who knows? It's the kind of thing which you could sort of imagine how it could be figured out, even though we haven't a clue today how to go about figuring it out. Okay, now the next picture that you have. Now, one way to perhaps attack the problem, how could I know the color and the hardness of an electron, is maybe to measure both at the same time. Why use two boxes? It seems that you measure for color, then you measure for hardness, that destroys the color. So what you'd like to do is build, well, there's on the left-hand side here, a color and hardness box with four spots. Up at the top, you got white and hard and white and soft. Out the side, you got black and soft and black and hard. And then, you know, you have one shoot for each possibility, each combination, and then you'd know what it was, both its color and its hardness. The trouble is, no one has been able to figure out how to build such a thing, unless you put inside this big thing two boxes, a color box and a hardness box. No one has ever been able to figure out how to get a kind of measurement of both together. Again, it's just that no one's been able to figure it out. But it is peculiar, since, as I said, these properties seem to have nothing to do with one another. In fact, it's a little more than that. The property has nothing to do with one another. If I go through the color box and it comes out white, so I say it's white. Push it back through as many times as I like, it always comes out white. Now I go to the harness box, it's 50-50. So clearly the color is not correlated with hardness. All the ones I've tested for white come out 50-50. All the ones I've tested for black come out 50-50. So there's no connection between the color and the hardness. There's no way that we've been able to discover, to predict. You know, what happens is it goes through the color white and keeps going around. Then it goes through the hardness and comes back and it's 50-50. Maybe we could figure out which ones get hurt. Right? They're all white. So the natural thought is they're all white, so half of them are changed to black. So maybe we could figure out how they're different. So you sort of keep records of the different way, different characteristics electrons might have, try to find a correlation between, you know, the left-handed electrons go through and get turned black, and the right-handed ones not. Or the chocolate electrons get turned black, and the vanilla ones not. Or something! No one's able to find any quality of electrons that correlates in any way with whether you get turned black or not. But again, this is just we haven't been able to find. It's not yet a terrible, horrible problem. Okay. Now look at the top thing here. It's a little more complicated. Here you have a hardness box. Standard hardness box. Electron comes in to the left. If it's soft, it goes out horizontal. If it's hard, it goes up vertical. Then, each way, it comes to a mirror, which reflects it. And then, it comes to a black box, and goes out. The black box is just like a double mirror, pushing things out in the same direction. So, the electron goes in at the bottom left, and no matter whether it's hard or soft, it comes out exactly the same way at the top right, going off at an angle. That's all this does. Now, let's test this thing and see how it works. First of all, imagine closing off the S slot so that the electrons, when they come in, let's ask you, see how if you're following me. And if I close off the S slot, right, it's wall it up, dam up that hole. When I put electrons in the left, what's going to happen?
When you go out through the top.
So what will happen? As I put the electrons in, what's going to happen? Half of them will come out the top, and half won't come out. The hard ones will come out the top, and the soft ones will run into the block and stay there. Right. And we can test this. I dam up the soft hole. I put in electrons from the left. When they come out the top right, I can test them with another hardness box to see what happens. And see whether they test hard. They always test hard.
What's the difference between putting it through a different hardness box than to put it again through the same chip?
Well, I agree with you, intuitively, but you know, in science, when you have a new setup, you don't just automatically assume that everything will be the same. You test. So let's test. Let's test as carefully as we can. Right? Block off the soft thing, even with the mirrors and the black box at the end. If it can only go up, the ones that go up come out. When we test them in a regular box, they test hard, just like they should. Same thing if you block off H and they come out S. Half of them come out, as they should. The other half will run into the block. And the ones that come out to S, when you test them later, they're always S. You can do the same thing with the color. If the thing tests white, and you block off S, tests white, you put it in, half of them go up H, and come out, and test it again with the color, 50-50. Same with the bottom. All the same results apply when you use this thing as it stands. Now, let's imagine the following experiment. I put it through the color tester, and it comes out white. Then I put it through this contraption, the contraption on page 7. What is the contraption on page 7? It's a hardness system, with the two things coming out, the H slot and the S slot, and two mirrors, and they all come out the top right. So I put it through the color and it comes out white. Then I put it through this contraption. And then I'm going to put it back through the color tester. What ought to happen?
50-50.
50-50, for sure. Because when I put it through the contraption, either it goes through the H slot, which means it came out hard. The hardness tester tested it for hard. It got bounced around by a couple of mirrors. And we know that they're going to be 50-50. We tried that. And if you go through the S, it'll be 50-50. We tried that. So now I'm opening both of them and letting it go through. It's going to be 50-50. Well, guess what, boys and girls? When you put it back to the color tester, they're all white. They're all white. Something has gone wrong. Something's gone wrong. Look at this last diagram. as he puts it. Now we're in trouble. This is just a little picture of the complicated thing. And here you have a sliding wall that can stop it when it comes out the S-trap. Okay? If you put the sliding wall in front of the S-trap so it gets stopped, and then the ones that make it to the end only came out through the H, off the mirror and out the end, you go back to the color tester, they're 50-50. If you put a block on the H track, sliding wall, and they come out the S track, and they come out the diagonal at the end, put it back to the color, they're 50-50. But if you take out all the sliding walls, and you let both tracks be open, and it goes through, they're all white, and they stay white. Now let's think what our options are here. Back to this contraption, right, on page 7. How does the electron go? Well, you know, if it comes in on the left, it goes out S, and goes out the diagonal, then it's got to be 50-50. We know it's got to be 50-50, because if I block off H and let them come out S, it's always 50-50. So let's suppose H is open and it comes out S. Could that make a difference? The electron's only going one way. So if it's coming out S, the fact that H is open can't have any effect on the electron. That's the path untaken, right? Friends, that jerk. Right. And vice versa. If it goes out H, my block off S, that can't make any difference to the electron. It's going up H. And we know what happens when it goes up H. When it goes up H, it comes out as 50-50. Somehow, when we open up both paths, they all stay white. So now, what does the electron do? Does the electron go through path S to get out? It can't do that, because if it goes through path S to get out, it's got to be 50-50 again. Does it go through path H to get out? Can't do that, because if so, it's got to be 50-50 at the end. So maybe you'll say that this is a mysterious device. For some reason, putting in mirrors changes everything. And maybe you'll say, when you put an electron here into this thing, it splits up. It somehow splits up into two things, it goes both ways. That's the problem. It's not going one way, it's going both ways. But we can test that. Because we can stop the experiment in the middle and take a look. And every time we stop the experiment, take a look, remember the cat? Take a look, you only find one electron on one path. You never find two electrons, two ghostly electrons, two half electrons, two cousins of electrons. You always find one electron on one path, whenever you look. So it's not going out S, it's not going out H, it's not going out both. What's the only other possibility? Going neither. But that's not right either. Because if you block both paths, nothing gets through. So now, it's not going S, it's not going H, it's not going both, and it's not going neither. And that does seem to be all the possibilities. What else is left? So as he says, on page 11, second paragraph, what can such electrons be doing? Well, let's start with the top paragraph on 11. So what we're faced with is this. Electrons passing through this apparatus, insofar as we're able to fathom the matter, do not take root H, do not take root S, do not take both of these roots, and do not take neither of these roots. And the trouble is that these four possibilities are simply all the logical possibilities that we have any notion of whatever how to entertain. What can such electrons be doing? It seems they must be doing something which has never been dreamt of before. Electrons seem to have modes of being, or modes of moving, available to them, which are quite unlike what we know how to think about. On this, everyone agrees. This is nothing, it just has a very vivid way of explaining it. But there's no controversy here. What I want to point out is, however, that when you look, everything is normal. There's one little blip. One little ball. One little spark. That's all. When you're not looking, they move in a way that nobody can understand. Nobody can fathom. No one can picture. No one can explain. But when you look, bang, it's all normal. There's just one thing there. Look at the next paragraph. The name of that new mode, which is just a name for something we don't understand, is superposition. What we say about an initially white electron, which is now passing through our apparatus with the wall out, is that it's not on H, and not on S, and not on both, and not on either, but rather that it's in a superposition of being on H and being on S. And what that means, we don't know. That's what we say. Those are the words we use. And if you're an undergraduate and you like to mystify the whole, now we know it's superposition. But if you ask them, what does it mean when you say superposition? We don't know. We just know that it's not on H and not on S and not on both and not on either. Yeah.
I was just, maybe that's why superposition sounds like superstition, you know?
Okay. It's somehow a kind of combination of being on both. But not being on both, it's a combination, a weird combination which needs imaginary numbers and so forth and so on. But, so in order to make sense of what happens when you don't look, you have to say that when you don't look, it's not really there. That's the cat that goes behind the couch. And the cat goes behind the couch. There's nothing there but blue-green foam. When you look, it's always a cat. The minute you take your eyes off it, it becomes something else that moves in ways that we can't even picture or fathom or understand or explain. Now, as I said, he elaborates this in a much more precise fashion, and he adds other elements which make it much more accurate. But I just want to point out that we should be astonished that our looking should have anything to do with it. What has our looking got to do with it? Why has my looking changed what it is? Does it know I'm looking? Is it embarrassed? I mean, what? We're talking about an electron. You know, how can the fact that I'm looking change the reality? How can it have anything to do with it? By the way, I don't have to look. I don't have to look. What happens when the wall is in? When the wall blocks off the S root, I'm not looking. Still, the one that comes out the H root, you push them back through the color tester, it's 50-50. They're going to get destroyed. It seems that I don't have to look. It's enough if I know. It's enough if I know. If I know without looking.
I know what?
I know which way it went. How do I know which way it went? Because I blocked off the other route. So I don't have to look. I don't have to interfere with it. I don't have to test it or push it or have the electrons bounce off it. You know, the photons bounce off it so that I'm interfering with it. No. I don't have to look at it at all. I send it through this thing with the S root blocked, and I watch only the color tester at the end, and I can tell you what's going to happen. I can tell you from experience. Bitter, bitter, frustrating, unintelligible experience. I know that it'll come out 50-50. And I take out the wall, and I'm not looking. They're always going to come out white. It has nothing to do with my interacting with them or interfering with them. It has nothing to do with that. And even if I were looking, surely that doesn't change what's happening to them. They're running along. You know, when the cat runs along behind the couch, if I look over the couch, that has no effect on the cat. If the cat is there and light waves are bouncing off the cat, if I see them, it doesn't affect the cat. They're bouncing off whether I'm looking or not. So the fact that I'm looking doesn't have any interaction with the cat. The cat's just doing what it's doing. Yeah.
I mean, you can't really say that with such a small particle just because... the act of measuring it does. I mean, isn't that what you're saying? That like,
There's no measuring going on here. If I put a wall in, I'm not measuring. I don't measure the ones that go out the top. I know they go out the top because they can't get out the bottom.
Right.
I know. I don't know it by pushing them, but touching them. It's the same apparatus, but without a wall.
You're looking or you're knowing doesn't change them. It's the fact that you have a problem that you don't know the answers to. And you know certain things about it, but the fact that you're looking at that, that's been changing. Because you have a problem, you don't know the answers.
Well, I think it's a little worse than that, because if I don't look, I get certain predictable, stable results.
Yeah, that's just, but they're the things you do understand or know what the answer is going to be. That doesn't change it. It's just you don't know what's going on.
Let me suggest that I finish the sentence, okay? And then we can continue. All right. What I started to say was that I don't have to look at anything. If it's going through both channels, because both channels are open, I get predictable, stable results. And when I put in a wall, I get predictable, stable results. They're different. That's the problem. But they're predictable, stable results. The only difference is that when I put in the wall, I know which way it went. And if I take out the wall, I don't know which way it went. So the only difference that's correlated with the difference of the results is whether I know or I don't know. That's why it's so weird, right? Richard Feynman says the same thing. John Wheeler says the same thing. They all say the same thing. Nobody has any different discussion of this. Now, this is what's called the measurement problem. There's a wonderful book on this called Quantum Measurement by Nick Herbert, where he gives the 8 leading theories of quantum measurement, all of which have terrible problems. But everyone agrees that if we look, the foam goes away and the thing becomes a particle. Everyone agrees that because we see it. That we observe that. That's part of our observation. It seems then that the world is responding to what we know. When we know, that changes everything. If we don't know, it doesn't change. Indeed, there are tricky experiments where you can repeat these kinds of measurements over and over and over again, and where the looking only takes place at the end. And that triggers somehow, backwards, different results all the way back. It's almost something like backwards causation. If you get them far enough apart, and you only look at the end, that's going to change all the results as you go back. It's very, very weird. There are mirrors here, right? It comes out, bounces off a mirror. When an electron bounces off a mirror, it gives a push. So suppose I put a little spring on the mirror to detect the push. That kills it. That kills it. Because I know. Now I know which way it went. Then they come out 50-50, white and black. Without a spring, then it comes through 100% white. With a little spring, it comes out 50-50, white and black. Any way of detecting where it is, knowing where it is, kills the statistic. Now, that's this experiment. And there are other many other experiments which have the same upshot. What do they want to say? They want to say something like, it didn't go out the H root, it didn't go out the S root, didn't go both, didn't go neither. It's in some kind of combination of those two possibilities, but not just both on both roots, no. It's some kind of combination of those two possibilities, which we can describe in mathematics, but if you ask me, on the table, what's happening? No one has anything to say. We just know that if you write down these mathematics, then you'll get a prediction of the probability of the end, you know, whether it'll be 50-50 or whether it'll be 100%, we can tell you what the probability will be. But no one can tell you what's going on the table that makes it happen that way.
First of all, looking and non-looking thing, does that apply? This experiment?
It's this experiment. It's the two-slit experiment that they all describe. All of them are like this. Coordinated properties all have this characteristic. You can test each one separately. When you test one, the other one returns to 50-50.
So maybe when the time that light hits our eye and is processed in our visual cortex, There's the fact that it's such a certain specific particle or something going on between the time that light hits the eye and the time it's processed.
But if I'm not looking, it doesn't go on.
No, it changes.
One second. But if I'm not looking, it doesn't go on?
Or not looking, there's no light hitting the eye.
But it's bouncing off the particle. The fact that I'm not looking doesn't change what happens to the particle, unless you're doing what I'm doing. My looking changes it. But physically, my looking doesn't change it. The particle is there. Light is bouncing off it, going all directions. The fact that some of it comes onto my retina doesn't change what's happening to the particle. It doesn't affect what's happening to the particle. I'm downstream from the particle.
When we're not looking, how do we know that it's really the same?
Because I run it through the tester. I run it through the color tester. When I didn't look, it comes out to be 100%. When I did look, it's 50-50. So something happened, and the only difference is that I'm looking, I'm downstream. I'm not touching it. I'm not sending any signals at it. The light is shining on it, whether I'm looking or not. It's very weird.
When you test it, you experiment.
Okay. If you listen carefully, we just went through that twice. Now, listen again. My testing here is only knowing which way it went. I can know which way it went without interfering with it at all. Imagine that light is pouring into this thing all the time and bouncing off this thing all the time. If I close my eyes, I don't see the light. So I don't know. If I open my eyes, I do see the light. And so I do know. That doesn't change what's happening to the particle. By opening my eyes, I don't interfere with the particle. It's being interfered with the same way all the time, whether my eyes are open or closed. Right? So then my opening my eyes and knowing which way it's going is not interfering with the particle.
But the fact of the testing is it's been interfered with in the first place.
But it doesn't come out the same with my eyes open and my eyes closed.
If it comes out the sort of hard tester, you don't know if it's black or white until you put it through the black and white tester. And only by putting it through the black and white tester, you're interfering with the particle.
And when I have one slit closed and it comes out and I put it through the same tester in exactly the same way, why should it be different? I'm doing the same procedure. I'm using the same test both times. Sure it does, because if you interfere in the same way, then the interference can't be what's doing it. If you interfere in the same way, you get different results.
You don't even understand the test.
On the contrary, we understand them very well. They're designed to test for a certain property, and they successfully test for it. These things didn't drop from heaven. They were designed by scientists to test.
Because it says it's white. If you test the hardest, then you don't know if it's white or not. But you've already determined it's white.
Well, now you're saying the problem. But we know it's a...
We don't understand this, but yeah, obviously, we don't understand A, and yet you're on, like, X, Y, and Z, and so...
No, that's not so. When we put it, we test it for color only. So, when you put them through, originally, they're 50% white, 50% black. And when one comes out white, you put it back through, it always comes out white. Well, that means that it's testing for white. How else would you explain that? 50% of new ones come out white, 50% black, but if it comes out white, it always comes out white again. How would you explain that?
Can we actually see the color?
It's not color. It's asymptotic spin. All right. These are just words for other properties that electrons have. But we know from experiments they have a certain mass, they have a certain charge, they have a certain spin. Right? These are the properties that electrons have. So you see them in experiments. You see them exhibit these properties, and you build a detector for these properties. You would never have had any doubt about the accuracy of these testers if this particular result hadn't come up. Well, what kind of doubt are you going to put on it? We know that when you use it alone, it's utterly reliable. So the doubt will have to be, when you use it, this one, and then that one, then it affects this one. That's what the doubt will have to be, because when I use it alone, nothing goes wrong. But now, there is no way to explain what connection there is between this one and that one that makes that one affect this one.
And then you can't build up the whole story and then say, at the top, you can't understand this.
No, my friend, that's not correct. When each one is working separately, we understand them very well, and they work exactly as they were designed to work and expected to work. It's only when you put them together. So it has to be something about the connection between the two of them that makes the difference. But now, when I look at the particular connection there is between the two of them, we see that there can't be such an explanation. Now, I'll go through it once more, but then after that, you'll have to review the pictures yourself. Right? When it goes through a color tester, it comes out white. And then it goes to a hardness tester, color goes back to 50-50. Now I have this contraption on page 7. This contraption is a hardness tester with mirrors. I run some tests on this tester. For one thing, I block off S and I let it come out H. It behaves exactly the way every hardness tester that has an H slot behaves. I block off H and I run out S. It behaves exactly the way a hardness tester that has S, that come out S behaves. If I put a white one in, it comes out, it comes back out, it's 50-50. Every time. Now, if I open up both roots and I send through one electron, the assumption is one electron goes through one root. So if it goes through one root, it can't matter if the other root is open. And I tested this one root already by itself, and I know that this one root behaves the way the one root behaves on any hardness tester. So how come when I open up both roots and I send through one electron at a time, I get entirely different results? How can that be? It's an ordinary hardness tester. I tested each root separately and they worked fine. If an electron is coming out one root, it can't matter that the other root is open. So how then do I get different results? That's the puzzle. And the puzzle to which contemporary science has no answer. Except to say I have statistics to predict what will happen if you do it this way. But that's not an answer to what's happening. Now, the next step, which makes this even more difficult, I can't do this in detail because it's too complicated, I'll just tell you about it. This is an electron. You did it with a photon, you get the same thing. You did it with a proton, you get the same thing. Neutron, same thing. They've done it with atoms, whole atoms, silver atoms, you get the same thing. Somehow, These things, when nobody's looking, aren't going this way, and they aren't going that way, and they aren't going both ways, and they aren't going neither way, to sort of turn it to foam or something. Fuzz. But now reflect. What are we? Aren't we just made of those particles? Aren't we made of electrons, protons, neutrons, photons? I mean, going in and out anyway. Atoms? Aren't we made of that stuff? So why aren't we fuzz? How come we boil down to one way or the other? Well, in science, the goal is to account for our observations. That's the whole game of science, to test things by observing them. Now, when I put it through the color tester, it comes out one way and stays stable, because I go round and round and it always comes out the same way. I see that. So I have to account for the fact that it gets stabilized. Right? So I said, we're looking. But what I left out in the first description is that we are made of those things just as much as anything else is. So if, when they're not being looked at, particles really turn into fuzz, and if we're all particles, and the thing that's doing the looking is just particles, then it all ought to be fuzz. It ought to be fuzz forever. Where can there be something that's outside the particle fuzz that changes the fuzz into a definite property? For this reason, certain physicists, like Eugene Wigner, who had a Nobel Prize, and others, have said you need to have a non-physical observer who can change the fuzz into particles. Because if it's a physical observer, he too is going to be fuzz. The fuzz spreads everywhere.
It doesn't matter if it's a single or if it's multiple.
Observers?
Let's say
I'll tell you, the later chapters of this book, which are very mathematical, he's exploring that possibility. That's the one that he wants to explore mathematically. And I know he talks about that, and I haven't been able to figure out what the difference is. But I want you to know that this is one of the accepted positions, one out of eight accepted positions in quantum mechanics. Accepted. One of the hopes, one of the dreams, one of the guesses as to how this thing works, to say there's got to be a non-physical observer who collapses the wave function, who performs the measurement, his consciousness performs the measurement so that the thing collapses. Imagine something like this. This was Schrodinger's experiment. The particle goes through this thing somehow, whatever it does, and it can go on S or it can go on H, we think. That's how we think about it. You know, it's two slots. Right? When I'm not looking, it didn't go on S, it didn't go on H, it didn't go on both, it didn't go on neither. It's in never, never late. But when I look, I always find it on one or the other. Now imagine that down the path of S, there's a gun with a trigger, sensitive enough so the electron can trigger the gun. And suppose the gun is aimed at a cat. And out the H path, there's no gun, and no trigger. Now, this was Schrodinger's Erwin Schrodinger's question. I haven't looked yet. Is the cat alive or dead? Not only is the particle not here and not there, not on one, not on the other, not on both, but now the particle is going to affect the life of the cat. If it goes one, because once I look, the cat may be very unhappy. Because once I look, I sort of trap it on one path. And if I look and my looking traps it on S, then down the road it's going to be dead. But suppose I don't look at all. Suppose I just wait 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You know, we know how fast electrons go. It's been through already, and I haven't looked. So, what happened to the cat? Every book that's explaining quantum mechanics has to talk about Schrodinger's cat. That's, it's a subject that can't be avoided. Now you say, well, but the cat knows. So surely the cat is enough? Well, is it? Or isn't it? The cat's just another bunch of particles.
Unless you say cats are big enough. People want to say cats are big enough, and then they have to give a cutoff point. Because the particle isn't big enough, and the particle is carrying its own information. No, that's not big enough. And you put another particle, that's not big enough. But then if you get something as big as a cat, it is big enough. So where's the cutoff point? Nobody knows, and nobody can explain in any motivated way why there should be a cutoff point. This is called the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. I want you to understand two things. Number one, that what happens when you're not looking is extraordinarily weird. We have no way to picture what's going on there. And secondly, when you take a look, you make a dramatic effect on the world. And that sounds to me like the world cares whether we're looking or not. The world is set up in such a way that whether we're looking or not makes a difference to things that it shouldn't make a difference to. Where the electron cannot know that I'm looking at it. And still, what it's doing depends upon whether I'm looking or not. And that means that, in a way, according to those who say that it's got to be a non-physical consciousness, that's direct evidence for the soul. And indirectly, if my looking can change the way the world is working, then the world is sensitive to me in ways that are very strange, very unexpected, and at present, inexplicable.
According to that person that you said that the reason why we're not all fuzzy is because there's got to be something non-physical looking, could that be the explanation of that?
Okay, the truth is, dare I tell you this? The truth is, they are very careful to say that the fuzz is real, so even God can't be looking. Because if God were looking, there wouldn't be any fuzz. And if there wouldn't be any fuzz, then when it came out, it would be 50-50. How does it stay all white? It stays all white because it's fuzz. Why is it fuzz? Because no one's looking. So even God can't be looking.
But how do we know that it's fuzz?
My word fuzz is just short for saying it didn't go through S, it didn't go through H, it didn't go through both, and didn't go through neither. Those we know because we can rule them out experimentally.
Right.
If it went through S, when it came to the color, it would be 50-50. Right. If it went through H, it would be 50-50. If it went through both, so then when I looked, I'd sometimes find two. If it went through neither, when I blocked both routes, it wouldn't be stopped. I know experimentally that those are not correct. So that's when I say it's fuzz, right? Superposition, that's just fuzz, is one syllable, so it's easier to say. Right? And since he says we don't know what superposition is anyhow, so, you know, it's not much worse than that. Right? So if God were looking, that would be enough to collapse the fuzz, then when it came out, it would always be 50-50. The whole point is that it's fuzz because no one's looking. Now, the truth is, now the word looking is taking on a lot of space. Right? God could know without looking.
So can we?
Yeah, that's true. God could know without knowing. In other words, not knowing what we know. Now, something about our knowing does the job, and what he does might not interfere. Right? Because God is on a different plane altogether. So I don't know what to say about that. They picture God as a kind of superhuman, you know. So they say, he can't know either, because we know from experiment that if you know, it collapses the fuzz, and you get, and it's always 50-50 at the end. Yeah.
But during Ben's morning, they showed us a video here on Torah Science, and they said the same thing. And actually quoted, I think it was Eisen Tanachal from the Talmud, a place where it says the very same thing. I was wondering if you knew the source for it, because I don't remember.
I don't know any source, and I must tell you that, I mean, I'd be very happy if it's found it, but...
I didn't take up any space.
Beware of... That has nothing to do with this. Talking now about definite, stable, experimental results that can be predicted and can be tested over and over again. We're talking about something else, and a contradiction in description. Here's the description. Understand. The description is perfectly stable. I can tell you under any experimental condition exactly what's happening. It's just that what's happening can't be explained by any normal interactions. By the way, I'm going to have to go teach in the other place. I just want to give you one final remark. Very often you'll hear people say this. An electron, a photon, all these things. When you treat them one way under one experiment, they behave like a particle. And when you treat them a different way, under a different experiment, they behave like a wave. And that's the problem. That sometimes they behave like a particle, and sometimes they behave like a wave. That's wrong. It's wrong. It's doubly wrong. First of all, it's wrong in describing the experiments. And second of all, it wouldn't be such a big problem. Things behave a different way under different circumstances. That's no contradiction. No. In the exact same experiment, under the exact same conditions, it behaves both as a particle and a wave. That's the problem. That's the problem. It behaves determinately like a particle and determinately like a wave under the exact same conditions. Because when you take a look, all you get is a little blip. And if you let things slide to the end of the experiment without looking, then the results are not particle results. They're wave results. Although when you look at the end, all you find is a particle. But the results of what the particle do are wave results. That's the problem. It's the same experiment under exactly the same conditions. Richard Feynman makes this very clear in his lectures on physics, and the popular accounts and the instability here has nothing to do with measurement. All these instabilities are traceable to the nature of the... It has nothing to do with interference. It has nothing to do with interfering with the particle. It has to do with the nature of the particles and how their properties are related to one another. If nobody ever interfered with anything, it would have exactly the same results. Yeah, last question.
You describe it as superposition of fuzz, but I don't... How does that explain the fact that they come out 100%?
It doesn't. He says supervision. It's quoted. It's on your thing there. Superposition is just a word for something we don't understand.
So, you're saying either comes out H or comes out S or comes out both or neither. But
it doesn't come out H and it doesn't come out S and it doesn't come out both and it doesn't come out neither. And a word for that is fuzz. Superposition is just a word for that.
But whether or not it comes out H or S or neither or both has nothing to do with whether it comes out 100% white. I don't know why we're even discussing.
No, if it were to come out H, then it would be 50-50,
right.
And it isn't. So it can't be H. If it were to come out S, it would be 50-50, and it isn't. If you tell me it goes both, then sometimes when I stop the experiment, I don't find things are both paths, and I don't. If you tell me it goes neither, then how come when I block both paths, nothing gets out? That's my experimental proof that it doesn't go H, it doesn't go S, it doesn't go both, and it doesn't go neither. So what does it do? I don't know, it goes to the moon. Superposition is just another way of saying it goes to the moon. It doesn't explain anything. It's a word. Without explanation of what the word means, you have no explanation of what it does. As he says, the rest of the book is trying to give a little account of what people have said in trying to explain it and showing the weaknesses and difficulties with it.